Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic, and guide to all things cinematic and videomatic. What do you say instead? Anyway, he joins us weekly. The films Time and Crazy, Not Insane. And what do you say in addition to all things cinematic and videographic, or is it?
You can say that if you want, or if you want to, you can say cinematographic. And videotronic. I mean, yeah, there are all of these words, and they're mostly interchangeable, and some of them are old-fashioned and some of them are new-fashioned. But yeah, there really, I guess, is no exact video equivalent for cinematic.
I'm going to change it to Cinevid.
To what?
Cinevid.
What a good idea. Yeah. Well, I'm sure we can probably change the English language right now if we continue down this path.
I'll stop.
But I don't think that's 100% necessary. Right. Usually people know what you're talking about. In the early days when video was becoming a really important force, when, for example, VCRs were going into people's living rooms and whatnot, it made me uncomfortable that people would say, I'm going to video this or I'm looking at a video. It seemed to me it ought to be a videotape. But of course, videotape is now not something you run across that often. Now it's all digital. So I guess ideally, we should not use the term video at all. We should maybe talk about digital stuff. But then again, there are analog forms of video. So you see what a tangled pathway we are heading down here just by thinking about these words. So I say, let's just talk about movies this week. That's actually my term of art because they're things that move. They have images that move. So film and video, it's all movies. So with all of that settled, let's talk about this week's movies, which are both documentaries. And I might want to mention a couple of other documentaries along the way. But the first one I want to talk about is called Time. And that is T-I-M-E. And it's a very nice, very personal sort of a documentary, very nicely done, made by one Garrett Bradley. And it's a little bit unusual because it's one of these documentaries about somebody who is fighting the legal system. And I'm not the first critic to point this out. Normally, documentaries about people fighting the legal system are about people who are somehow been found guilty of things that, of which they are innocent or have given horrifically unjust sentences for things that were not all that severe, and the person fights the system and either wins or loses, and that's what the documentary is about. In this case, the person did it. And there's really no – in fact, the people did it. There's really no question about that. But that does not prevent this from being a very interesting documentary. I don't think it's a great documentary, but it's a very interesting one. So this is about a couple, and this man named Rob Rich and his wife – Fox Rich tried to rob a bank, and it did not go well. As it happened, she took a plea bargain and served something like 3.5 years in prison, whereas her husband was sentenced to a whopping 60 years in prison. So the wife, having decided that this is all very unjust and shouldn't be, shouldn't have happened, and they want redress for this tremendous inequality and so forth. And also, these are not bad people. For example, the movie shows a lot of footage of their kids growing up and so forth. And, you know, they're nice people, but their family, of course, is devastated by the husband being in jail for all this time and, you know, maybe never, ever going to get out till the end of his days, if then. And so the wife simply goes into battle mode against the legal system. And she does it in a way, you know, you can't really go into battle mode. You have to sort of do it in diplomatic ways. And so she has to do certain things like phone up a certain judge's office every single day, waiting for word on how some particular writ or some particular petition or something is going to turn out. Things like that. And the movie follows them over a very, very long period of time. And fortunately for the movie makers, and it's probably one of the reasons why this movie was made, these people, this family, they liked to videotape things a lot. And so you do have a whole lot of home video that you can sort of that it worked into the story. And that's one. That's how you, for example, you get to see the kids growing up into being very nice young people and all of that. And the movie, it has a very modest look. It's all in sort of black and white, and it's about, again, very ordinary, everyday sort of people. Nothing fancy about them, nothing fancy about their story. And I certainly won't tell how the story turns out, but it's a very interesting case of a case where somebody is really fighting hard to sort of bring a family back into existence against tremendous odds, when in fact the reason that the family was knocked apart, this crime, this major crime, attempted bank robbery, really did happen, which is kind of interesting. So it's a good movie. It didn't stir me to my bones or anything like that, but I found time, and the title is very appropriate because it's about the passage of time as the wife is fighting for the husband's behalf, and also, of course, about the time he's serving in prison and the time he's sentenced to serve in prison. Very well-titled movie. It's very absorbing, and I had a really good and interesting and sometimes moving time watching it. Now, I want to say that the sort of one of the prototypes for this battling the legal system kind of a thing and investigating a case and trying to prove something to the criminal justice system, one of the great classics of that sort of genre, if that's what it is The Thin Blue Line. Made by Errol Morris many a long year ago, back in the late 80s. And there we had, and by the way, it is such a timeless documentary, The Thin Blue Line. If anyone out there has never seen it, I totally recommend it. Even though it's about a case that took place many, many, many years ago, and it's all in the past and all of that. At the time when the movie was made, it was not all in the past, and it's just a very artfully made documentary. Errol Morris is a real artist as well as a seeker of reality in his documentary. And almost all of his movies have been documentaries. And so The Thin Blue Line, I think, is always going to be, again, a sort of a prototype for this kind of movie. And in that case, I will give a little bit of a spoiler here, but in that case, Errol Morris's investigations and what he brought to bear in putting together his movie and in making his movie actually got this guy released from prison, where he was in, you know, never going to get out. So it was a really interesting case on that, and it's kind of funny because I was on the selection committee of the New York Film Festival back in those days, and we saw the movie and we really, really liked it, but we saw it in the spring and our festival took place in the fall, and we said, my gosh, if we choose this movie to be in the New York Film Festival at Lincoln Center, of course Errol Morris will be delighted and everything else, but then they won't be able to release the movie until the fall, and this poor guy will have to spend more time in jail. So as things turned out, the distributors, Miramax, at that time a very respectable organization, decided to release the movie fairly soon anyway, so it was not available to us for the festival. But that's always been, I think, sort of an amusing anecdote, our worrying that if we selected this movie for our festival, we might be keeping a guy in the lockup longer than absolutely necessary. I mention Errol Morris not only because The Thin Blue Line is, again, a sort of a prototype for this fighting against the justice system kind of a thing, but because he is very much around these days. First of all, he has a new movie out, a new documentary of his own, called My Psychedelic Love Story. And this is not really going to be, it's going to be premiering on Showtime, I guess, in about a week or two. So I won't go into it at length now. It's not quite out yet. And I don't think it's one of Errol Morris's greatest documentaries, but it's really interesting. And it's all about the woman who was Timothy Leary, the psychedelic guru of the 60s and 70s. It's all about the woman who was, to use an old-fashioned term, his mistress for many years. And they traveled together, and they did drugs together, and they did this and that, and she's still around. Well, actually, she was still around. She died shortly after the movie was finished, very, very recently. But it's a very, very interesting sort of portrait of her, and through her, of the late Timothy Leary, who was a notorious and interesting character in all kinds of ways. I also want to mention Errol Morris's other current project, Project, which is a miniseries on FX called A Wilderness of Error. And this is an unusual case where Errol did not direct the movie himself. It was directed by one Mark Smerling, but Errol Morris is sort of the main talking head in it, and it's based on a book that he wrote about the very, very complicated legal travails of Jeffrey McDonald, who was a military MD, a military physician, accused of murdering his whole family, which he blamed on rampaging hippies. And Errol Morris did a long, long, long investigation of this and wrote a very, very long book about it. And now the book has been turned into this miniseries called A Wilderness of Error. And one of the fascinating things about this is that it does not come to firm conclusions in the end. Errol Morris says after all of his years of investigation and after his hundreds of pages of writing about it, et cetera, he really to this day isn't really sure who's guilty or what happened and so forth. So it's a fascinating case of a documentary being willing to admit its own ambivalence and its own ambiguity. So I really recommend that. Again, it's not exactly in Films in Focus wheelhouse because it's a mini series, but it's a very, very interesting one, A Wilderness of Error. I really do recommend it. And if you want just a movie, then there's always Time, which deals very much with a milder crime than murder, but which is very, very interesting in its treatment of the criminal justice system. And the other movie I want to talk about today, Jill, is Crazy, Not Insane. This is a movie by the very, very major documentary maker Alex Gibney, who makes movies about mainly political subjects. His most recent film before this one, just a few weeks ago, was Totally Under Control, about America's failure to meet the crisis of the coronavirus pandemic in an effective way. And his other films over recent years include The Inventor, Out for Blood in Silicon Valley, and Citizen K. He makes really, really, really interesting, very often political documentaries. Well, Crazy Not Insane is not exactly a political documentary, but I found it absolutely fascinating. I think it's probably the year's best documentary and one of the year's very best movies. So here's what Crazy Not Insane is about. It's basically a portrait of a psychiatrist named Dr. Dorothy Lewis. And she has spent her career investigating and doing research on basically serial killers. Now, this is not a very appealing subject. Most of us might not choose to go into this area of research, but that's what she's really devoted a lot of her career to. She's been always fascinated in her professional life as a psychiatrist with people who commit murders. And to commit one murder, of course, is something that I think for most of us is unimaginable. But how about people who commit lots of them, one after another? She got involved in this line of research pretty early in her career. And one of the things that she did was to do some really pioneering research, not entirely on her own, but pioneering research that helped to establish what I think is now regarded as the fact that if you look hard enough, you find actually damaged brains in the people who commit these horrifying crimes. Now, I think it's a truism. We're a lot of us familiar with the idea that people who are badly abused as children often grow up to be abusers themselves, and sometimes even killers, and sometimes even serial killers. So we know that. But what she's saying is that this is not entirely, at least in probably the great majority of cases, just a matter of psychological forces. It's also physical forces. If you really, really look at that brain, you're going to find certain things wrong, and actual damage in certain places that are probably bringing this horrible, horrible behavior about. Now, she does not say to understand all is to forgive all. She totally acknowledges we've got to keep these people behind bars because they are very dangerous and we don't want them coming and killing us or our loved ones or anybody for that matter. But it's a fascinating thing that she's done to discover through her research, again, often in partnership with others, all of these really interesting things. And one of the sort of subcategories within this work that she does is, again, what appears to be very pioneering work on what used to be called multiple personality disorder, the kind of thing that you saw in one form in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, in another form, The Three Faces of Eve, those sort of old stories. But it now has a different name. It's now called dissociative identity disorder. And I think to this day, a lot of really smart psychiatrists say it doesn't exist. There's no such thing as people with multiple personalities who switch from one to another under certain circumstances, etc. What she maintains is that this disorder absolutely absolutely does exist. And my golly, this movie presents a lot of evidence that certainly seems pretty convincing to me. There are people who she can sort of trigger from one personality to another by using certain words, by asking certain questions, by bringing up certain topics. Now, of course, these people who we're dealing with here are people who have committed horrific crimes, and they may be acting, they may be pretending, they may be making it all up. Okay, of course, that's possible. And hey, you know, the real world is not always definitive about these things, as some researchers such as Errol Morris really recognize. But in this case, Alex Gibney really seems to believe in Dorothy Lewis's theories, and he really allows her to present her case in a very forceful way while allowing others to make cases against her case from time to time within the movie. And I found the whole thing riveting. There is fascinating footage of some of these serial killers and others being interviewed, going through their various stages of their multiple personality changes and so forth. And there's just a whole lot of fascinating factual material about the danger posed by serial killers and how criminal justice and medicine have been responding to these things right up through the present day and where these things might go in the future. So I think that the two documentaries I've talked about today, Time is a very nice one and a very good one and a very important one. But Crazy Not Insane, I think, is a really superior movie, and I totally recommend it to anybody interested in psychiatry, in medicine, in criminal justice, or just in the problems of violent crime in today's American society. And that is my non-fictional story this week, Jill.
For which we thank you as ever, David Sterrett. Films in Focus, the films Time and Crazy Not Insane.